From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much for doing that. You're helping put this show on the air right now. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you could help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We're in the middle of the High Holy Days on the Jewish calendar. Let me extend our warmest greetings to everyone who is observing this sacred season. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a judge has ruled against the University of Iowa for ejecting a campus group, InterVarsity, that excluded LGBTQ students on religious grounds. It's the second time the university has lost such a case. The name of the deeply religious student group that got the court's earlier blessing to discriminate: Business Leaders in Christ. Of course. It was quite a week at the Vatican. It began with meetings between Pope Francis and various faith leaders to discuss pressing social issues, including a private audience for leading LGBTQ Catholic advocate and America magazine editor, Father James Martin, who shared very positive impressions of the conversation. Toward week's end, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took his turn meeting with the Pope and later hyperbolized that religious freedom is more at risk today than even when Pope John Paul II and Ronald Reagan were working together to bring down the Iron Curtain. And to the surprise of no one, the only voices shrieking more loudly and incoherently than Fox News talking heads in attacking anyone involved in the presidential impeachment proceedings are those of the political religious right. It exposes the depressing reality that a wide range of powerful, purportedly faith-driven characters are verifiably enthralled to only one very mortal deity, Donald J. Trump. Endless mailings, interviews and broadcasts from the likes of Family Research Council President Tony Perkins are nakedly and exclusively partisan, not to mention ubiquitous Texas megachurch and media pastor Robert Jeffries.
I think it's hard to take Nancy Pelosi's call to prayer seriously, and I've literally spoken to thousands and thousands of evangelical Christians. I have never seen them more angry over any issue than this attempt to illegitimately remove this president from office, overturn the 2016 election, and negate the votes of millions of evangelicals in the process.
Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio. And I feel the need to preface this with a caveat. News is breaking nonstop at the intersection of this administration, its theocratic enablers, and American electoral politics. There's no way we can chase the latest headlines on this show. There's the possibility that some of what we discuss this hour will have changed before the words leave my lips. But we'll do our best, as we do every week, to focus on what's most important and not just on what's the loudest or most provocative at a given moment.
But I think the key to Iowa is going to be who has the best ground game, because let's remember, it's a caucus state, right? Mm-hmm. And the way you caucus there is way different than any other state in the country.
February 3rd, 2020 is still a long way off, but when it comes, it will be the first opportunity for voters to weigh in on the deep bench of Democrats running for the White House. That will happen in Iowa, as the state hosts caucuses that are the first in the nation tally of voter preferences. Interfaith Alliance of Iowa is deeply involved in making sure the campaigns don't neglect issues of religious liberty and church-state separation. And on this week's show, we'll get an update from Executive Director Connie Ryan. Interreligious organizing is tough. Tough enough in an ostensibly secular nation such as ours. Things get all the more complicated when one religion is enshrined as dominant in state and cultural circles. But that hasn't stopped one faith leader who has devoted his life to building bridges of diversity in the deeply Orthodox Christian Republic of Georgia. I'm looking forward to speaking with Metropole Bishop Malkhaz Songgulashvili. But first,
President Trump repeatedly enlisted Vice President Mike Pence to join in his pressure campaign on Ukraine.
Pence likely would have received detailed notes of the president's call with Zelensky.
If the vice president knew about that and was involved in that, to me, that not only taints him, but it makes him ineligible as well for the presidency.
The nation has been roiled by presidential impeachment proceedings for almost 2 weeks now, as well as by the increasingly shrill and incoherent responses from the president and his minions. At a moment like this, eyes naturally turn to the vice president, although right now that seems to be happening less in hopefulness and more in alarm. We're fortunate that our first guest this week is Tom Lo Bianco, author of the comprehensive new book, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House, and a journalist who has covered the vice president for numerous leading news outlets going back to the Indiana State House. Tom, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Reverend. It's good to be here.
You've been covering Mike Pence since he was governor of Indiana. He's famously guarded. After all of this time, do you feel like you really know this man?
Not entirely, but I feel like I got a better sense of him, definitely. By the time I finished the book, and I spent, you know, kind of 2 years really intensively on the book after, you know, spending all this time reporting on him, and I just feel like there's a human trapped in there that we don't see very often, and it's kind of clouded out by the caution and the political ambition, which is, I mean, really true of a lot of politicians. But for him, it's just like, we don't see the humor. We don't see him talking a lot about his private faith. We hear more of like the political faith and the playing to the Christian right, but we don't hear a lot about his private practice. And I don't know, by the end of it, I just felt like, I want to see that guy. Like, I want to hear more about the guy from high school who was like a prankster, you know?
Is the vice president you see today the same person you reported on in those earlier years?
He's changed quite a bit. And you know what? Even signing on with Trump was sort of a rapid fire change. It's, you know, he goes through these evolutions. I see him as sort of he's like a lagging indicator of where the politics of the moment is, because he's always kind of catching the wave just as it's cresting. Look, you know, when he leaves, when he's in Congress, he kind of starts out to the right of W. Bush, kind of hitting him on different things like social conservative issues and spending. Then he kind of moves into more of a Tea Party mold later in his congressional career, moves back to Indiana to run for governor. But he runs for governor not as a Tea Partier or a social conservative, he runs as a technocrat, somebody who's kind of eschewing the social conservative issues. And he doesn't really, when he signs up with Trump, he kind of reverts back to that more of playing to the Christian right model, but also more acrid. He's become more acrid since he's been with Trump. He's kind of dropped the nice guy thing, which was a hallmark of his for, you know, 26 years almost.
People have talked about what would it be like if Mike Pence was the president of the United States. Does Mike Pence even want to be president of the United States?
Yes, very much so. But let me point out something important, because I feel like there's been a lot of misconceptions about this out there. I've heard people say that they felt like they were him and I say they, I mean Mike and Karen, because it is very much a joint operation. That they felt like they were predestined to be president of the United States. That God had predestined them. One, that misreads their personal faith. That's not how that's sort of a Calvinist view of things. That's not how they practice or how they see things. But two, you see a change in him from about 2008 onward, and that's when he starts to become more serious about running for president. I interviewed a real interesting, his name is Reverend Robert Shank, and I'm sure
I know him, yes. Probably. Know him well.
Yeah. Reverend Shank was fascinating because he used to pray with Mike Pence in his office, in congressional office, and then he said that his take on this is that Pence has a discipleship problem. He said that Pence has not given himself completely over to Jesus, and that secular Mike, the one with the ambition, often wins out over Christian Mike, and he needs to unify those two and start listening more to God and making those decisions based less on secular decision making and less on the ambition. And that, I mean, to me as a political reporter, someone who kind of comes at it from the other side, more from the secular world, that was really fascinating to hear through the lens of, no, from his faith, he has not given himself over completely.
That is really interesting. If it came to that, and he became the president, what's the one word that you would use to summarize a Pence presidency?
A very conservative version of George W. Bush. I'm sorry, that's like 8 or 10 words.
And if I understood you right, it's a little to the right of Bush.
Yes, sir. Yeah, much more to the right of George W. Bush.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be very Trumpy, but I can almost guarantee you this: it would be in terms of free trade. You would not see a return to on that, because that's where the populace has shifted, the political base on the populist right. But yeah, very conservative version of George W. Bush, and I don't think it would be. You know, I hear from some folks on the left that concerns that. He would be a fiery theocrat. That's not what he does. It's not his style. He does play to that crowd, most certainly. He gives talks to groups like John Hagee's, Christians United for Israel, some Zionist groups and whatnot. He plays to them, but he's not firmly ensconced in that world.
Tom, Donald Trump has become a darling of the political religious right, but he's not one of them. On the other hand, Mike Pence, Mike Pompeo, Sam Brownback, and an ever-growing number of characters in this administration are either Christian supremacists, rapture anticipators, or both. What do the traditional targets of the religious right have to fear if Pence were to assume the Oval Office?
Well, look, on the social policy, you could pretty much guarantee that he's going to align himself very closely with the Christian right, if not completely. But I don't know that. Remember, his goal is a political goal, and it's winning. So, you know, let's say hypothetically that Trump were to be removed from office by the Senate if he's impeached, and then Pence becomes president. His immediate goal becomes not pleasing one group or another. It becomes figuring out which one's going to help him get elected in his own right. And that calculation changes how he acts on policy. And it's not the only thing. Like, it's not purely a political decision. To understand him as president, as a potential president, I think the best barometer is when he was governor, because it's the one time that he's in an executive position. He's long time been a legislator, but it's the one time he's in an executive position, not answering to anyone else, kind of left to make his own decisions. And there are some things that are not squarely on the right that he does. You know, remember, he expands Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons he does expand Medicaid is because of the high infant mortality rate in Indiana. And in that case, he comes at it through a faith perspective. They were very concerned. Him and Karen were very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes and does something that's, you know, more centrist and to the left. There's a little more complexity to him than we know.
I see. You write that VP Pence's signature line is, "I am a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican," in that order. And you say that is strikingly honest. And then you write, "But the unstated quality that pulls rank on all others is that he is a politician first and foremost."
Yeah, this is kind of his style of how he talks about politics. It's sort of every politician has a type of misdirection that they use. And it's not that he's dishonest. It's just that he kind of, it's errors of omission. And in this case, when he's saying that, he leaves out that he's a politician foremost. Now, it doesn't mean that he's not a Christian. It does not mean that he's not conservative or Republican, because clearly he is all those three things. But it's the politician and the political decision making and the ambition that pulls rank. And it wasn't always that way. Again, you know, when I said that he started changing in 2008, once he starts putting that focus on the White House, that's really when his ambition starts taking over. And I think that's where he is today. I mean, that's why he's standing next to Donald Trump. That's why he's trying to hold that Trump base of voters in his own right. So, yeah, politician number one. You should throw politician, then Christian, then conservative, then Republican in that order.
Is he politician enough? Is he so interested in becoming the leader of the land that if he sees an opening in the situation that we're in right now, would he do what he could do quietly to put himself up as, I can help us right now and I need to be president?
I don't think he'll ever explicitly break with Trump, because politically that would be a career suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And his people have made that point before. But I do think that there has to be some breaking point for him. I don't know that Ukraine is it, because you see him supporting Trump right now. Mm-hmm. In that. But if things take a serious turn south, I don't want to go too far out on the speculation.
Sure.
Because it's just very hard to tell at this moment.
Sure.
I think we have a lot. Yeah. So to your listeners, I would say keep your ears open, though, because the Ukraine thing is moving very fast.
Yeah. You know, contempt seethes from administration figures like Miller and Conway, and it's also noticeable with Pence and Pompeo. Tom, how much of that is based on the incredible confidence absolutist religious beliefs bestow on believers? Are these characters sincerely convinced of the superiority of their religious beliefs, which makes dissenting views and even democracy itself superfluous?
Well, I can tell you based on my reporting that superiority, the absolutism, my understanding is that comes more from Karen Pence. Mike Pence himself is not like that. And that's not his personal style, but he does play to that world. That sort of that absolutist world, the folks like Robert Jeffress and whatnot. So I guess the question then becomes, you know, if you spend a lot of time playing to them, do you perhaps become them? And I best I can tell, he's struggling in that right now. You struggle. You don't want to lose yourself. And that's kind of a classic question of the human in politics, right? Like,
sure.
You don't want to, as you morph and try to, appease these different groups, you know, how much of yourself, your own core, do you lose?
Mm-hmm. I was captivated by the report on how the Pences handle the Access Hollywood tape. Of course,
yes.
They were shocked and somewhat shaken. They said that all they could do was pray. Now, I wondered what they were praying for, but you pointed out that numerous friends asked them to pull out of the partnership with Trump. And finally, the Pences decided to stay at Trump's side, and they said, they prayed, and finally they said, we knew we were signing up for something we'd never do. It's disappointing, but it doesn't change the mission.
Yeah.
What mission were they talking about?
Well, for them, the mission is winning the White House in their own right, and the original calculation was that Trump would lose in November 2016, and then they would be catapulted towards the front of the pack for the Republican nomination in 2020. That's why they were doing this. I mean, there's another thing too. It's never just one singular facet in things. The other item is that they do believe that this is part of keeping the country on track. I'm sure your listeners will know about this, the biblical allegories of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, and then all Joseph and the Pharaoh. You know, this is something his people talk about periodically, and it's that Pence is the godly man, the cipher of God, who's put there to keep everything running okay and to protect his people. That's another way that they explain all this.
Yeah.
It's never clean one way or another. You know, there's
right.
the ambition and the faith kind of. They tug at each other, and they're both mixed together. They're mixed together in this.
Is the way he treated or they treated that particular situation a signal of what they have been doing a lot of times since they've been at the White House? Has that been the formula for dealing with hundreds of other moments when the Pences seemed to stand strong by the president, even when they didn't like what the president had done, or even when sometimes they affirmed him when he was lying and they knew it?
Yeah, I mean, his people talk about it in terms of, you know, this is what they view as servant leadership, and that it is staying quiet and doing the work and not really questioning. Now, occasionally he will do things like try to nudge Trump back on track. But he's not active. He doesn't really fight Trump on anything. That's why, I forget exactly what it was over. I think it was over Iran. He had some stories about how John Bolton and Mike Pence had pushed back on Trump regarding Iran. I actually took Pence at face value when he tweeted that he had not done that, because that is not his style inside the White House. But in terms of, you know, how do they survive it? They view it as being subservient to Trump, and also trying to keep things from going too far off the rails one way or another. Kind of that old idea of, you can affect change more inside than you can from outside.
When you see him day after day standing behind the president, with the president and vice president has this cover of his face, you can't tell what he's thinking about or what he's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever see that and say, I know what he's thinking about?
Well, sometimes it looks like he wishes he could disappear from the room.
Right.
I know it does test his patience, but everyone tells me that he relies on his own personal faith. It does a lot of praying to mm-hmm. derive some patience to survive all this stuff. I don't hear a lot of people telling me that they think that Pence likes, you know, people who cheat on their, you know, cheating and the, you know, paying off porn stars, paying hush money, and all the sort of the bawdy stuff that we see from Trump and the insults online too.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he never speaks out against it.
Yeah. There is one sentence in your book that I think impacted my view and feelings about Pence more than any other part of the book. The reason he, Pence, is in the White House serving next to a man who made a living breaking almost every Christian bromide, someone so amoral that Pence once said anyone fitting that description should be immediately impeached, is because, in the end, ambition and the hunger for power outweighed anything else. Talk about that.
I think we see when he signs on with Trump that this is the ambition eclipsing the faith and the principle. It's never fixed one way or another. It's not. I don't see it as 100%. I don't see that he completely loses himself. But I think there's a decision at some point that this is. They will go on board with Trump, and this is the ambition overtaking them. And again, it's that arc that starts in 2008. It's that arc of they get bit by the ambition bug in a serious way. The conservatives come to him in 2008 and say, will you run for president against Mitt Romney in the Republican nomination? And his tactics from then become more about winning the White House than anything else.
So, Tom, would you say that right now, at least Mike and Karen, if they don't say it to anything else, say it to each other, we've mm-hmm. got to bide our time. Our time will come, and we will run for that office and pray that we win.
Yes, 100%. This is about biding their time and being patient, and the focus is on 2024. As best I can tell.
What does every American need to know about Mike and Karen Pence at this critical crossroads in American history?
I think he's got a better chance of becoming president than most people know. And you want to know the reason I say that is because I underestimated his political skills early in my career. I underestimated his chances. I never thought he would make it to the White House, and here he is, vice president to Donald Trump. So I made that mistake before, and I would say that he's got better political skills and discipline than most people understand.
I guess we come full circle, because you mentioned this at the very beginning of our interview. You wrote, as I reported and researched for this book, I grew more empathetic of Pence, his religion, his politics, him as a flawed human. Mm-hmm. What extracted empathy for him in you?
I think I used to see him more as a political caricature and from the surface level. And I think I found him struggling more with how his own faith and his ambition. It's just, you know, that's what I heard from his friends when I would interview them. That's what I heard from people who knew him at different points in his career. They would tell me how he changed. And I thought people would tell me what a great humorist he was, about how he often used to tell these great jokes and, you know, get people laughing. It was very affable, and how we don't see that anymore. And I don't know if it's like, if it's lost or if it's just hidden away, but I kind of wondered, I was like, God, what happened to that guy? Like, where did he go? And I don't know. It just feels like, and some of that is just what happens in politics, right? Yeah. The higher you climb, the more cautious you get. But for him, when he signed on with Trump, especially too, I think it feels like a key part of that is lost. And it's sort of tragic in a way.
How does he handle these moments like right now when people are saying, well, he's done the same thing the president did and he didn't tell the truth? That's not the first time that's been said. How does he handle that?
Hiding.
Yeah.
Hiding. That's what he did during the Access Hollywood weekend. It's what he did during Trump Russia. Recently he was at an event, a couple of events, and reporters try to yell questions at him about Ukraine, and he ducks the questions. Hiding.
I know that you didn't get to interview him for this book. How's he going to like this book?
On the whole, I hope they appreciate it because, look, there's good, bad, gray, black, white, everything in between in there about him because it's a portrait of a human being. I mean, I've had some people come to me and tell me I'm too much of a Pence apologist. I've had other people tell me that it's a hit job. People used to ask me that while I was reporting it. The only thing I hope as a journalist, as a chronicler of this man, I hope it's complete as we can get, because we need to make those judgments for ourselves, that old Enlightenment philosophy. Put the information out there and let the populace decide. So I hope that's what I've accomplished here.
Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House, is a book rife with worrisome insights and troubling truths. But that also provides essential background to prepare for whatever is facing this nation and the world in the uncertain month ahead. Tom, I know you're one of the most in-demand interview guests in the entire country this week, so we're particularly thankful that you were willing to take this time and be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you, Reverend. It's an absolute pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. You'll hear about one Baptist faith leader's lifetime of interreligious leadership in the Republic of Georgia. And later, what are the presidential candidates saying in Iowa? I'll ask Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Earlier in my career, I had the good fortune to work on founding and then being a leader in the Alliance of Baptists. That's one of the Baptist groups in the United States. And that's the organization that put us in touch with the remarkable Bishop Malkas Sangulushvili. Bishop, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me there.
You know, there are all kinds of Baptists in the United States. I assume that your polity and terminology are different from most, if not all, American Baptists. How does your congregation relate to your affirmation and affiliation with the Evangelical Baptist Church in the Republic of Georgia? Are you unique?
Well, in a way, we are unique because we are Baptists, which means congregational, and we are also Episcopal, which means we have got bishops. So we are amalgamation of two different ecclesial systems, congregational and Episcopal, which seems to be working fairly well in Georgia, bearing in mind that the culture is very old, ancient, Christian, Eastern Orthodox culture. We are the system of being congregational as well as Episcopal works fairly well. This makes us distinct not only in Europe, but in the rest of the world.
Did you grow up in this tradition?
Yes, I did grow. I was born into a Christian family. My father was a minister of the Baptist Church. My mother was extremely active as well. And my grandmother was actually a lay preacher. And later on, when I became bishop of the church and traveled to the rural areas of the country, often came across some elderly people who would say, "You know, son, it was your grandmother who brought the gospel to our village." So I'm very proudly Baptist in this tradition, and I'm very fond of the legacy and freedom our denomination can have.
Are there challenges specific to leading this ministry in an Orthodox Christian country? And if so, how do you overcome those?
Well, it must be in the genes of the Baptist Church of Georgia that in every single generation, we have to deal with some challenges. Our challenge in my generation is to fight against Islamophobia, xenophobia, and homophobia. And these are three main challenges we have to cope with. And it has also been a tradition of our church to find creative ways to handle challenges. For instance, when there was Islamophobic outburst in Georgia, and we felt quite helpless, we decided to create a liturgy which would include members of the LGBTQ people, and also the liturgy would be celebrated every month in solidarity with that group. There was outburst of Islamophobia and xenophobia in the country, and we decided to do something creative, and this is how the idea of building a small synagogue and small mosque at the Peace Cathedral came into being. So we wanted to do creative projects to react to the Islamophobic, homophobic, or xenophobic outbursts in the country.
Mm. So how has that gone within your own congregation?
Well, I had to deal with these challenges wearing two hats, as it were.
Mm.
One being the Archbishop of the Evangelical Baptist Church of Georgia, mm-hmm. and another being Metropolitan Bishop of Tbilisi.
Mm-hmm.
So it was much more difficult to deal with these issues as the Archbishop of the Evangelical Baptist Church of Georgia,
mm-hmm.
because of some ministers and some laymen were against it. So that was the reason why I resigned from the archiepiscopal position. But I had full support in my second job, as it were, as a metropolitan of the Tbilisi diocese. So through my diocese, I had full support both of clergy and laity who thought clearly that we needed to do something for the people who have been sidelined by the mainstream, both religiously and culturally.
Mm. I'm sure that some of our listeners will want to know, how did you ever find yourself in this role, in this place?
Well, I was born into a Baptist family. As I said, my father was a minister and my grandmother was a lay preacher, etc. And I was trained as a historian and I was a professor at the State University when Soviet Union collapsed. And the church felt very, very deeply and clearly that they wanted to have new blood into the veins of the denomination. And being a professor, I was invited by the church to lead the church in new setting when the Soviet Union was gone, oppression of religion was gone, and the church was to forge a new identity. I met with the leadership of the church and also with the National Council of our church and spoke openly and candidly that I would be happy to accept this position of the Archbishop of the Evangelical Baptist Church of Georgia, providing that the church would be open to changes.
Mm.
And I had full support from clergy and laity of the country who wanted to have a leader. I was very young then. I was 29 years old, professor at the State University. But since I saw unanimous support and decision of the Council of the Churches to have a new leader with a new perspective, bringing changes to this the church and also to the country, I accepted the position.
Mm. Some months ago, you were invited to go to Iraq, and at the shrine of Imam Hussein in Karbala, you delivered a speech on the Treatise of Rights, a document attributed to Imam Sajjad, the 4th century Imam of Shia Muslims. What did you say, and how were you received?
Well, what I said in my paper was that if we affirm the sovereignty of God, that means we should affirm human rights as well. Human rights in modern sense and human rights in ancient sense. And the treatise Imam Sajjad has produced is a remarkable piece of work. It speaks about rights of God and rights of human beings, rights of members of the family, rights of the relatives and friends, and rights of the minorities. So I studied this document very carefully and presented the case saying that affirmation of the sovereignty of God requires affirmation and acceptance of diversity, be it religious, cultural, or otherwise. The acceptance was quite unexpected, I should say. I gave a talk in the presence of top-ranking ayatollahs and imams of Shia world. And when I finished my paper and came down from the podium, I was approached by the number two cleric in the Shia world, thanking me for the paper and also urging me not to stop with the paper and continue building relations between Muslims and Christians, which I thought was a wonderful compliment to receive, and I'm really determined to work in this direction.
Oh, absolutely, and it's an amazing thing. I listened to you with some envy because I still run into a lot of people in the United States who do not necessarily relate God to human rights. They may talk about religious rights, but they don't talk about human rights. I just admire you for putting those two together. Did that come slowly, or has that always been there?
Well, I think it did come slowly. It took some time to see the connection. And I should also admit that recently, as I had to work on the paper, I realized that there's a deep connection. Imam Sajjad is talking about right of God and right of human beings. And to see this together so eloquently and so conspicuously presented was a real discovery. And it was affirmation of my understanding that God's rights, human rights, religious liberty all belong together.
Yeah. Through mutual friends, I have learned a lot about the peacemaking that you have done where you are, especially between Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims. You have invited both sects of Muslims to worship in the Baptist church where you worship. I wish you would talk about the kind of reconciliation and peacemaking between these two Muslim groups that you have been about.
Well, the interfaith work has been going on in Europe for more than 50 years. It started particularly in the aftermath of World War II. But my observation is that we need to go deeper. And going deep means to be honest and open and candid in this relationship by extending the friendship to Shias and Sunnis and others, and also helping them to relate to each other. We create spaces where they can come together on a sort of neutral ground, talk to each other, eat together, celebrate together, and this is what the Baptist Church has been keen on. We also believe that it is essential not to be simply observant of religious services in these two respective communities, but also to participate in them. It opens a new dimension of friendship, trust, and confidence. And I think if the interfaith dialogue has to have the future, it will depend on building confidence, mutual confidence, and also deepening friendship and love between the communities. Mm-hmm. And I think this role of bringing Muslims from Shia and Sunni background together and providing the space where they can meet and share and also build confidence is an essential one.
Well, you know as well as I do that a lot of people have not traveled that road enough for us to have the kind of cooperation that we should have. I'm curious again about you personally. What were the shaping truths, the teachings, and the events that moved you in the direction toward which you've traveled and in which you've worked?
I think the key word to this very profound question is encounters. Encounters with Muslims, Sunnis, and Shias, and having time with them, working with them, either in refugee camps or hospitals or elsewhere, doing advocacy work on behalf of those communities, has really shaped my understanding of being a Christian minister. Sometimes I have to say that I became a Christian minister and a bishop owing to my work with my interreligious colleagues and friends, with Sufis and Shias and Sunnis. And I think the encounters with people whom we do not know, people who have been sidelined by the mainstream could be not only healing, but edifying as well. And I believe that while committing ourselves to the interfaith dialogue, we can receive more than give out because these encounters can immensely enrich us. Our understanding being human and our understanding being people of faith.
Yeah. In my own interreligious work, which I've done across the years, some people have told me, I would say maybe attacked me, in telling me that I have blasphemed my Christianity by worshiping and praying with Muslims. Did you have to wrestle with your own Baptist tradition to pray with Muslims and to work with Jews as you have done?
Many times, but primarily with Baptists from Eastern Europe and other neighboring countries. The Baptists and Christians in general consider Muslims and Jews and others as being part of religion which has nothing to do with our own tradition. But the truth of the matter is that both Jews and Muslims represent members of the same family we all belong to. And praying with them is a very natural thing to do because we all believe that there is only one God. We all also believe that the founder of our faith tradition, whether biologically or spiritually, is Abraham. And also something very important to bear in mind that we are all human beings. And therefore, I find extremely comfortable to pray both with Jews and Muslims and others in affirmation of sovereignty of God, who is one, who is full of kindness and compassion.
Mm. The Orthodox Church plays an undeniable role in politics in a country such as Georgia. Have you ever been made to feel that your interfaith work was an unwelcome challenge to that power structure?
Many times. I'm afraid to say that Orthodox Church has to do a lot with power structures and with political process. And therefore, I came across with confrontation both from the Orthodox Church and political forces in the domain of interfaith work, because they, both the church and some politicians in the country, consider Muslims or Jews or others as being threat for the national integrity. But of the truth of the matter is that it is the other way around. This diversity of religions can only contribute to cementing new democracy in Georgia, cementing the diversity we have in the country and we'll be celebrating.
What would you offer to American interfaith leaders and organizers as suggestions, as encouragement on how best to be healers and bridge builders at a time like this?
Well, first of all, I would encourage both American and Georgian and European colleagues of mine to give up the idea of proselytizing, which undermines possibility of having genuine and deep interfaith cooperation. This is number one. Number two, we need to see evangelists not as a way of evangelizing or proselytizing people, but a way to build harmony in this world which is torn apart by hatred and fear.
Metropolitan Bishop Malchaz Songbulashvili was born into a family of religious leaders in Tbilisi, Georgia, and has carried on that tradition throughout a life rich in spiritual integrity, exploration, and education. He was the head archbishop of the Evangelical Baptist Church of Georgia for almost 20 years, and today is diocesan bishop of Tbilisi and head of Peace Cathedral in Tbilisi. He teaches both at the Ilia State University and the Baptist Theological Academy. Bishop, it is great talking with you. I have great respect for the ministry that you are continuing. And I hope that we can meet again when you're in this area, because I'd love to continue this conversation with you.
By all means, I'm delighted to have a conversation with you, and I'll be happy to share my experiences in this fascinating work of interfaith partnership.
Iowa's on the mind of every presidential campaign right now. The first in the nation state caucus can make or break a candidate, and well-positioned to see how different campaigns are approaching the challenge is Interfaith Alliance of Iowa Executive Director Connie Ryan. Connie, great to hear your voice. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Thanks for having me.
What's it been like so far this year?
Well, you know, as usual, we have a lot of candidates that are going across the state and talking with folks, not only in big crowds, but also just shaking hands at local diners and other places. And in Iowa, we feel very fortunate and privileged to have that opportunity, and Iowans take their role very seriously. And so nothing is different except for the size and scope of the number of candidates, really. And the other thing I guess I would say is that the Democratic candidates seem to be more willing to talk about their own personal beliefs, mm-hmm. religious beliefs and otherwise. And so that has been a new narrative for us in the state and across the nation.
Is that dimension of their presentations related directly to the policies they want to talk about?
Oftentimes, yes. And it's an interesting conversation. Sometimes they are willing just to talk about it without any kind of prompting, and other times it is questions that are posed by voters, and they're willing to dive a little deeper than has been true in past years. But almost always they connect it to issues around health care or issues around poverty, civil rights issues, those kind of things that mix someone's personal faith beliefs and public policy and how it may impact their decision-making.
Have you had any strong impressions so far of the different campaigns and what they are bringing to the table that are different from each other?
They're similar. We certainly have candidates, as you well know, that are more, in our terms, more progressive, and others that are more moderate in how they approach public policy. We've talked obviously primarily with the Democratic candidates. We haven't seen as much from the Republican side of the aisle. But with the Democratic candidates, they do talk in terms of the public policies that matter to a lot of voters. So, as I said, healthcare is a big topic. Corporations and their impact on our democracy are a big subject matter. And they do, there's differences, nuances in their answers and how far they're willing to go. But I think at the same time, there's a lot of similarities of agreeing that things need to change mm-hmm. on a lot of these big topics. The details are the differences.
How is the state GOP handling this question of whether a presidential primary is even needed this year?
I don't know that they've said a whole lot about that. We will still have Republican caucuses, just like we have Democratic caucuses. Those happen at the beginning of February in 2020. I don't know that they've stated a whole lot about that, and they believe in the caucus system just like the Democrats do. So Republicans will gather just like Democrats do at the beginning of February.
I know Interfaith Alliance of Iowa has ambitious plans for speaking directly with the various presidential candidates. That is such a good idea. I'm interested in what you want to talk with them about.
Well, this started with the idea of sending out a questionnaire to all of the candidates on both sides of the aisle and asking them a number of questions, not only related to the big issues that we care about as an organization, but a lot of questions regarding pluralism and protecting that boundary between government and religion. So we, middle of the summer, sent out a questionnaire with 11 questions that we had narrowed down to. We received 10 responses back, including some of those top-tier candidates that are polling higher. And then we've offered to them to sit down and have one-on-one conversation or roundtable conversations with voters to really dive deeper into those questions. So we were thrilled to have 10 candidates respond, and folks can see all of those answers from those candidates on our website. We're hoping that the candidates will be interested in that deeper conversation and look forward to talking with them. I do know that they are appreciative of the opportunity. We asked open-ended questions that allowed them to freely express what they thought on those issues around, for example, should a candidate share their personal religious beliefs when running for public office? They could express more deeply and clearly what they thought about that question and the others as well.
Hmm. You know me well enough to know that there's one question that I want to ask about one issue, and that's religious freedom. Are you all right with the way religious freedom has been talked about, or if it has been talked about enough in Iowa?
I don't think that it's ever talked about enough. I think we could certainly use more opportunity to do that. I do think that the candidates that are talking about that are taking that question seriously and are pretty informed on the reason why it's important to talk about, not only in terms of protecting religion and the boundaries that we should put about around that for religious purposes, but also the protecting our government as well, protecting our democracy as well. And so the candidates seem to have a good understanding of why it's important to talk about that.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear you say that you're hearing them talk about faith and religion with some comfort in doing so. Does it feel like they get it and are unwilling to cede religious rhetoric and language to the opposing party, which I think has happened repeatedly in recent campaign seasons?
I think they get it on some issues. I think they certainly get it on issues related to LGBTQ civil rights, because religion has been used so often and so long to really bludgeon people's civil rights. And that's been part of the narrative in our nation. So I think the Democratic candidates understand how religion has been misused in our nation. I don't know that they connect all of the dots for all of the issues that religious freedom has been misused in other parts of the conversation. So I think that's why it's important for this questionnaire that we've put out and the continued conversations that we're hoping to have to really use it as a tool to not only hear their thoughts, but also to educate them on the issues that really matter.
What are the would-be voters like right now?
Well, I think that folks are really engaged in a broad spectrum of issues. Folks are very, very concerned about where our nation is currently and where our nation is headed. There is an onslaught of negative, hateful rhetoric that is happening across our nation, targeted at lots of groups of people. So whether it is targeted toward people who are Muslim or Sikh or immigrant or women, certainly still LGBTQ, we're seeing that across our nation. And I think it is very worrisome to the average, everyday person who understands what our democracy is really about and whether or not we can, even with, if there were to be a change in leadership, can we stop that tide of hatefulness that we have seen over the last few years? So I think they're looking for, I think voters are looking for someone that has the ability to lead and to change the course of what is happening in our nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a partisan manner at all. I think it is a matter of folks looking for someone that can look at the values of our nation and be a leader that upholds those values and the promise, really, of our democracy, that all people are welcome and all people have a place in our nation. And folks are looking for that person. I think there are many options out there, and folks need to take the time to dig down deep into what the candidates are saying.
As the campaign continues in the coming weeks, what are you going to be watching most closely for?
I'm looking for details. I'm looking for depth in a candidate. On a personal level, I want a candidate who understands those values that our nation really is meant to uphold, and how are they going to live that out if they were to be president? How are they going to work to bring our nation together as best that they can, because we are so divided on so many issues right now? How are they going to represent this idea of civility in our nation, that we can have a conversation and we can disagree with each other, but how we treat each other matters? All of those things I'm looking for, depth of understanding of who we are as a nation and the issues that are important to us, the details of their way of how they would handle different issues.
If you will, tell our listeners how they can keep up with the work of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa.
I would absolutely love that. Folks can see us on the web at interfaithallianceiowa.org. And that questionnaire that I spoke about earlier is our Faith and Democracy Project. There's a tab at the top that you can click on that, and you can see all of the candidates who have responded and their responses in full.
Connie Ryan is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, a position she has held for a remarkable 17 years now. As the presidential campaign heats up, Iowa is the center of attention as the first state-level caucus in the nation, and the alliance is working hard to ensure that the constitutional issues of true religious liberty for all and the separation of church and state are not left out of the conversation and of the campaign. Connie, it's great to be with you again. Thanks so much for what you're doing, as you've always done, and for being with us once more on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton, for all you do and for the opportunity, and so good to hear your voice again.
Now, before we go, I'd like to take just a minute to share the full text of a listener email we received this week. A listener from Ohio writes the following. As a gay man who has seen religion be used as an excuse for the oppression of the LGBTQ plus community as well as other minorities, I usually shy away from anything having to do with religion. However, your program is a very welcome change from that, as you use your position as a voice for inclusiveness and serving, treating and loving everyone as they are, and trying to further policies for inclusiveness. Thank you for that. I listen to your program every Saturday morning. It is a light in these dark times. Well, thank you for your affirming letter. It's important beyond measure for us to know that there are times we are able to make a difference, to make something just a little bit better than it otherwise might have been. We love hearing from listeners. Compliments and critiques are equally welcome. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you, thank you, thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make a contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You'll hear Andy Hanauer, the tireless founder of the One America Foundation, on how this inspired and optimistic initiative to rise above manufactured divisions continues to grow for the good of all Americans. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.